chattered away about whatever I wanted until I began to feel like an old lady talking to her two dogs. All the while, I poured sake as liberally as I could for both men. Nobu didn't drink much, but the minister held his cup out gratefully every time. Just as the minister was beginning to take on that glassy-eyed look, Nobu, like a man who has just woken up, suddenly put his own cup firmly on the table, wiped his mouth with his napkin, and said, "All right, minister, that's enough for one evening. It's time for you to be heading home." "Nobu-san," I said, "I have the impression your guest is just beginning to enjoy himself." "He's enjoyed himself plenty. We're sending him home early for once, thank heavens. Come on then, minister. Your wife will be grateful." "I'm not married," said the minister, but already he was pulling up his socks and getting ready to stand. I led Nobu and the minister up the hallway to the entrance and helped the minister into his shoes. Taxis were still uncommon because of gasoline rationing, but the maid summoned a rickshaw and helped the minister into it. Already I'd noticed that he was acting a bit strangely, but this evening he pointed his eyes at his knees and wouldn't even say goodbye. Nobu remained in the entryway, glowering out into the night as if he were watching clouds gather, though in fact it was a clear evening. When the minister had left, I said to him, "Nobu-san, what in heaven's name is the matter with the two of you?" He gave me a look of disgust and walked back into the tea house. I found him in the room, tapping his empty sake cup on the table with his one hand. I thought he wanted sake, but he ignored me when I asked, and the vial turned out to be empty in any case. I waited a long moment, thinking he had something to say to me, but finally I spoke up. "Look at you, Nobu-san. You have a wrinkle between your eyes as deep as a rut in the road." He let the muscles around his eyes relax a bit, so that the wrinkle seemed to dissolve. "I'm not as young as I once was, you know," he told me.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"It means there are some wrinkles that have become permanent features, and they aren't going to go away just because you say they should."
"There are good wrinkles and bad wrinkles, Nobu-san. Never forget it."
"You aren't as young as you once were yourself, you know."
"Now you've stooped to insulting me. You're in a worse mood than I'd feared. Why isn't there any alcohol here? You need a drink."
"I'm not insulting you, I'm stating a fact."
"There are good wrinkles and bad wrinkles, and there are good facts and bad facts," I said. "The bad facts are best avoided." I found a maid and asked that she bring a tray with scotch and water as well as some dried squid as a snack, for it had struck me that Nobu hadn't eaten much of his dinner. When the tray arrived, I poured scotch into a glass, filled it with water, and put it before him. "There," I said. "Now pretend that's medicine and drink it." He took a sip, but only a very small one. "All of it," I said.
"I'll drink it at my own pace."
"When a doctor orders a patient to take medicine, the patient takes the medicine. Now drink up." Nobu drained the glass, but he wouldn't look at me as he did it. Afterward, I poured more and ordered him to drink again.
"You're not a doctor," he said to me. "I'll drink at my own pace."
Now, Nobu-san, every time you open your mouth, you get into worse trouble. The sicker the patient, the more the medication."
"I won't do it. I hate drinking alone."
"All right, I'll join you," I said. I put some ice cubes in a glass and held it up for Nobu to fill. He wore a little smile when he took the glass from me, certainly the first smile I'd seen on him all evening, and very carefully poured twice as much scotch as I'd poured into his, topped by a splash of water. I took his glass from him, dumped its contents into a bowl in the center of the table, and then refilled it with the same amount of scotch he'd put into mine, plus an extra little shot as punishment. While we drained our glasses, I couldn't help making a face. I find drinking scotch about as pleasurable as slurping up rainwater off the roadside. I suppose making these faces was all for the best, because afterward Nobu looked much less grumpy. When I'd caught my breath again, I said, "I don't know what has gotten into you this evening, or the minister for that matter."
"Don't mention that man. I was beginning to forget about him, and now you've reminded me. Do you know what he said to me earlier?"
"Nobu-san," I said, "it is my responsibility to cheer you up, whether you want more scotch or not. You've watched the minister get drunk night after night. Now it's time you got drunk yourself." Nobu gave me another disagreeable look, but he took up his glass like a man beginning his walk to the execution ground and looked at it for a moment before drinking it all down. He put it on the table and afterward rubbed his eyes with the back of his hand as if he were trying to clear them.
"Sayuri," he said, "I must tell you something. You're going to hear about it sooner or later. Last week, the minister and I had a talk with the proprietors of the Ichiriki. We made an inquiry about the possibility of the minister becoming your Dana."
"The minister?" I said. "Nobu-san, I don't understand. Is that what you wish to see happen?"
"Certainly not. But the minister has helped us immeasurably, and I had no choice. The occupation authorities were prepared to make their final judgment against Iwamura Electric, you know. The company would have been seized. I suppose the chairman and I would have learned to pour concrete or something, for we would never have been permitted to work in business again. However, the minister made them reopen our case, and managed to persuade them we were being dealt with much too harshly, which is the truth, you know."
"Yet Nobu-san keeps calling the minister all sorts of names," I said. "It seems to me..."
"He deserves to be called any name I can think of. I don't like the man, Sayuri. It doesn't make me like him any better to know I'm in his debt."
"I see," I said. "So I was to be given to the minister because..."
"No one was trying to give you to the minister. He could never have afforded to be your Dana anyway. I led him to believe Iwamura Electric would be willing to pay, which of course we wouldn't have been. I knew the answer beforehand, or I wouldn't have asked the question. The minister was terribly disappointed, you know. For an instant, I felt almost sorry for him."
There was nothing funny in what Nobu had said, and yet I couldn't help but laugh, because I had a sudden image in my mind of the minister as my Dana, leaning in closer and closer to me, with his lower jaw sticking out, until suddenly his breath blew up my nose.
"Oh, so you find it funny, do you?" Nobu said to me.
"Really, Nobu-san, I'm sorry, but to picture the minister—"
"I don't want to picture the minister. It's bad enough to have sat there beside him, talking with the mistress of the Ichiriki."
I made another scotch and water for Nobu, and he made one for me. It was the last thing I wanted. Already the room seemed cloudy, but Nobu raised his glass, and I had no choice but to drink with him. Afterward he wiped his mouth with his napkin and said,
"It's a terrible time to be alive, Sayuri."
"Nobu-san, I thought we were drinking to cheer ourselves up."
"We've certainly known each other a long time, Sayuri. Maybe 15 years, is that right?" he said. "No, don't answer. I want to tell you something, and you're going to sit right there and listen to it. I've wanted to tell you this a long time, and now the time has come. I hope you're listening, because I'm only going to say it once. Here's the thing. I don't much like geisha. Probably you know that already. But I've always felt that you, Sayuri, aren't exactly like all the others."
I waited a moment for Nobu to continue, but he didn't. "Is that what Nobu-san wanted to tell me?" I asked.
"Well, doesn't that suggest that I ought to have done all kinds of things for you? For example, I ought to have bought you jewelry."
"You have bought me jewelry. In fact, you've always been much too kind. To me, that is. You certainly aren't kind to everybody."
"Well, I ought to have bought you more of it. Anyway, that isn't what I'm talking about. I'm having trouble explaining myself. What I'm trying to say is, I've come to understand what a fool I am. You laughed earlier at the idea of having the minister for a Dana. But just look at me. A one-armed man with skin like... what do they call me? The lizard."
"Oh, Nobu-san, you must never talk about yourself that way."
"The moment has finally come. I've been waiting years. I had to wait all through your nonsense with that general. Every time I imagined him with you... well, I don't even want to think about that. And the very idea of this foolish minister... did I tell you what he said to me this evening? This is the worst thing of all. After he found out he wasn't going to be your Dana, he sat there a long while, like a pile of dirt, and then finally said, 'I thought you told me I could be Sayuri's Dana.' Well, I hadn't said any such thing. 'We did the best we could, Minister, and it didn't work out,' I told him. So then he said, 'Could you arrange it just once?' I said, 'Arrange what once? For you to be Sayuri's Dana just once? You mean one evening?' And then he nodded. Well, I said, 'You listen to me, Minister. It was bad enough going to the mistress of the tea house to propose a man like you as Donna to a woman like Sayuri. I only did it because I knew it wouldn't happen. But if you think...
You didn't say that.
I certainly did. I said, but if you think I would arrange for you to even have a quarter of a second alone with her, why should you have her? And anyway, she isn't mine to give, is she? To think that I would go to her and ask such a thing.
Nobu-san, I hope the minister didn't take this too badly, considering all he's done for Iwamura Electric.
Now wait just a moment. I won't have you thinking I'm ungrateful. The minister helped us because it was his job to help us. I've treated him well these past months, and I won't stop now. But that doesn't mean I have to give up what I've waited more than 10 years for and let him have it instead. What if I'd come to you as he wanted me to? Would you have said, "All right, Nobu-san, I'll do it for you"?
Please, how can I answer such a question?
Easily. Just tell me you would never have done such a thing.
But, Nobu-san, I owe such a debt to you. If you asked a favor of me, I could never turn it down lightly.
Well, this is new. Have you changed, Sayuri? Or has there always been a part of you I didn't know?
I've often thought Nobu-san has much too high an opinion of me.
I don't misjudge people. If you aren't the woman I think you are, then this isn't the world I thought it was. Do you mean to say you could consider giving yourself to a man like the minister? Don't you feel there's right and wrong in this world, and good and bad? Or have you spent too much of your life in Gion?
My goodness, Nobu-san, it's been years since I've seen you so enraged.
This must have been exactly the wrong thing to say, because all at once Nobu's face flared in anger. He grabbed his glass in his one hand and slammed it down so hard it cracked, spilling ice cubes onto the tabletop. Nobu turned his hand to see a line of blood across his palm.
Oh, Nobu-san!
Answer me!
I can't even think of the question right now. Please, I have to go fetch something for your hand.
Would you give yourself to the minister, no matter who asked it of you? If you're a woman who would do such a thing, I want you to leave this room right now and never speak to me again.
I couldn't understand how the evening had taken this dangerous turn, but it was perfectly clear to me I could give only one answer. I was desperate to fetch a cloth for Nobu's hand. His blood had trickled onto the table already, but he was looking at me with such intensity I didn't dare to move.
I would never do such a thing, I said.
I thought this would calm him, but for a long, frightening moment he continued to glower at me. Finally, he let out his breath.
Next time, speak up before I have to cut myself for an answer.
I rushed out of the room to fetch the mistress. She came with several maids and a bowl of water and towels. Nobu wouldn't let her call a doctor, and to tell the truth, the cut wasn't as bad as I'd feared. After the mistress left, Nobu was strangely silent. I tried to begin a conversation, but he showed no interest.
First, I can't calm you down, I said at last, and now I can't get you to speak. I don't know whether to make you drink more, or if the liquor itself is the problem. We've had enough liquor, Sayuri. It's time you went and brought back that rock.
What rock?
The one I gave you last fall. The piece of concrete from the factory. Go and bring it.
I felt my skin turn to ice when I heard this, because I knew perfectly well what he was saying. The time had come for Nobu to propose himself as my Donna.
Oh, honestly, I've had so much to drink I don't know whether I can walk at all, I said. Perhaps Nobu-san will let me bring it the next time we see each other. You'll get it tonight. Why do you think I stayed on after the minister left? Go get it while I wait here for you.
I thought of sending a maid to retrieve the rock for me, but I knew I could never tell her where to find it. So with some difficulty I made my way down the hall and slid my feet into my shoes and sloshed my way, as it felt to me in my drunken state, through the streets of Gion. When I reached the Okya, I went to my room and found the piece of concrete wrapped in a square of silk and stowed on a shelf in my closet. I unwrapped it and left the silk on the floor, though I don't know exactly why. As I left, Auntie, who must have heard me stumbling and come up to see what was the matter, met me in the upstairs hallway and asked why I was carrying a rock in my hand.
"I'm taking it to Nobu-san, Auntie," I said. "Please stop me."
"You're drunk, Sayuri. What's gotten into you this evening?"
I have to give it back to him, and... Oh, it will be the end of my life if I do. Please stop me.
Drunk and sobbing, you're worse than Hatsumomo. You can't go back out like this.
Then please call the Ichiriki and have them tell Nobu-san I won't be there, will you?
Why is Nobu-san waiting for you to bring him a rock?
I can't explain. I can't...
It makes no difference. If he's waiting for you, you'll have to go, she said to me, and led me by the arm back into my room, where she dried my face with a cloth and touched up my makeup by the light of an electric lantern. I was limp while she did it. She had to support my chin in her hand to keep my head from rolling. She grew so impatient that she finally grabbed my head with both hands and made it clear she wanted me to keep it still.
I hope I never see you acting this way again, Sayuri. Heaven knows what's come over you.
I'm a fool, Auntie.
You've certainly been a fool this evening, she said. Mother will be very angry if you've done something to spoil Nobu-san's affection for you.
I haven't yet, I said, but if you can think of anything that will...
That's no way to talk, Auntie said to me, and she didn't speak another word until she was finished with my makeup.
I made my way back to the Ichiriki tea house, holding that heavy rock in both my hands. I don't know whether it was really heavy or whether my arms were simply heavy from too much to drink, but by the time I joined Nobu in the room again, I felt I'd used up all the energy I had. If he spoke to me about becoming his mistress, I wasn't at all sure I would be able to dam up my feelings. I set the rock on the table. Nobu picked it up with his fingers and held it in the towel wrapped around his hand.
"I hope I didn't promise you a jewel this big," he said. "I don't have that much money, but things are possible now that weren't possible before."
I bowed and tried not to look upset. Nobu didn't need to tell me what he meant. Chapter 33. That very night, while I lay on my futon with the room swaying around me, I made up my mind to be like the fisherman who hour after hour scoops out fish with his net. Whenever thoughts of the chairman drifted up from within me, I would scoop them out and scoop them out again and again, until none of them were left. It would have been a clever system, I'm sure, if I could have made it work, but when I had even a single thought of him, I could never catch it before it sped away and carried me to the very place from which I'd banished my thoughts. Many times I stopped myself and said, "Don't think of the chairman, think of Nobu instead," and very deliberately I pictured myself meeting Nobu somewhere in Kyoto. But then something always went wrong. The spot I pictured might be where I'd often imagined myself encountering the chairman, for example, and then, in an instant, I was lost in thoughts of the chairman once again. I went on this way for weeks, trying to remake myself. Sometimes, when I was free for a while from thinking about the chairman, I began to feel as if a pit had opened up within me. I had no appetite, even when little Etsuko came late at night carrying me a bowl of clear broth. The few times I did manage to focus my mind clearly on Nobu, I grew so numbed I seemed to feel nothing at all. While putting on my makeup, my face hung like a kimono from a rod. Auntie told me I looked like a ghost. I went to parties and banquets as usual, but I knelt in silence with my hands in my lap. I knew Nobu was on the point of proposing himself as my donna, and so I waited every day for the news to reach me. But the weeks dragged on without any word. Then, one hot afternoon at the end of June, nearly a month after I'd given back the rock, Mother brought in a newspaper while I was eating lunch and opened it to show me an article entitled, "Iwamura Electric Secures Financing from Mitsubishi Bank." I expected to find all sorts of references to Nobu and the minister, and certainly to the chairman, but mostly the article gave a lot of information I can't even remember. It told that Iwamura Electric's designation had been changed by the Allied occupation authorities from, I don't remember, a class something to a class something else, which meant, as the article went on to explain, that the company was no longer restricted from entering into contracts, applying for loans, and so forth. Several paragraphs followed, all about rates of interest and lines of credit, and then, finally, about a very large loan secured the day before from the Mitsubishi Bank.
It was a difficult article to read, full of numbers and business terms. When I finished, I looked up at Mother, kneeling on the other side of the table. "Iwamura Electric's fortunes have turned around completely," she said. "Why didn't you tell me about this?" "Mother, I hardly even understand what I've just read." "It's no wonder we've heard so much from Nobu Tashikazu these past few days. You must know he's proposed himself as your Donna. I was thinking of turning him down. Who wants a man with an uncertain future? Now I can see why you've seemed so distracted these past few weeks. Well, you can relax now. It's finally happening. We all know how fond you've been of Nobu these many years." I went on gazing down at the table, just like a proper daughter, but I'm sure I wore a pained expression on my face, because in a moment Mother went on. "You mustn't be listless this way when Nobu wants you in his bed. Perhaps your health isn't what it should be. I'll send you to a doctor the moment you return from Amami." The only Amami I'd ever heard of was a little island not far from Okinawa. I couldn't imagine this was the place she meant, but in fact, as Mother went on to tell me, the mistress of the Ichiriki had received a telephone call that very morning from Iwamura Electric concerning a trip to the island of Amami the following weekend. I'd been asked to go, along with Mameha and Pumpkin, and also another geisha, whose name Mother couldn't remember. We would leave the following Friday afternoon. "But, Mother, it makes no sense at all," I said. "A weekend trip as far as Amami? The boat ride alone will take all day."
"Nothing of the sort. Iwamura Electric has arranged for all of you to travel there in an airplane."
In an instant I forgot my worries about Nobu and sat upright as quickly as if someone had poked me with a pin. "Mother," I said, "I can't possibly fly on an airplane."
"If you're sitting in one and the thing takes off, you won't be able to help it," she replied. She must have thought her little joke was very funny, because she gave one of her huffing laughs.
With gasoline so scarce, there couldn't possibly be an airplane, I decided, so I made up my mind not to worry, and this worked well for me until the following day, when I spoke with the mistress of the Ichiriki. It seemed that several American officers on the island of Okinawa traveled by air to Osaka several weekends a month. Normally, the airplane flew home empty and returned a few days later to pick them up. Iwamura Electric had arranged for our group to ride on the return trips. We were going to Amami only because the empty airplane was available. Otherwise, we'd probably have been on our way to a hot springs resort and not fearing for our lives at all. The last thing the mistress said to me was, "I'm just grateful it's you and not me flying in the thing." When Friday morning came, we set out for Osaka by train. In addition to Mr. Beku, who came to help us with our trunks as far as the airport, the little group consisted of Mameha, Pumpkin, and me, as well as an elderly geisha named Shizue. Shizue was from the Pontocho district rather than Gion, and had unattractive glasses and silver hair that made her look even older than she really was. What was worse, her chin had a big cleft in the middle like two breasts. Shizue seemed to view the rest of us as a cedar views the weeds growing beneath it. Mostly she stared out the window of the train, but every so often she opened the clasp of her orange and red handbag to take out a piece of candy, and looked at us as if she couldn't see why we had to trouble her with our presence. From Osaka Station we traveled to the airport in a little bus not much larger than a car, which ran on coal and was very dirty. At last, after an hour or so, we climbed down beside a silver airplane with two great big propellers on the wings. I wasn't at all reassured to see the tiny wheel on which the tail rested, and when we went inside, the aisle sloped downward so dramatically I felt sure the airplane was broken. The men were on board already, sitting in seats at the rear and talking business. In addition to the chairman and Nobu, the minister was there, as well as an elderly man who, as I later learned, was regional director of the Mitsubishi Bank. Seated beside him was a man in his 30s, with a chin just like Shizue's, and glasses as thick as hers, too. As it turned out, Shizue was the longtime mistress of the bank director, and this man was their son. We sat toward the front of the airplane and left the men to their dull conversation. Soon I heard a coughing noise, and the airplane trembled, and when I looked out the window, the giant propeller outside had begun to turn. In a matter of moments, it was whirling its sword-like blades inches away from my face, making the most desperate humming noise. I felt sure it would come tearing through the side of the airplane and slice me in half. Mameha had put me in a window seat, thinking the view might calm me once we were airborne, but now that she saw what the propeller was doing, she refused to switch seats with me. The noise of the engines grew worse, and the airplane began to bump along, turning here and there. Finally, the noise reached its most terrifying volume yet, and the aisle tipped level. After another few moments, we heard a thump and began to rise up into the air. Only when the ground was far below us did someone finally tell me the trip was 700 kilometers and would take nearly 4 hours. When I heard this, I'm afraid my eyes glazed over with tears, and everyone began to laugh at me. I pulled the curtains over the window and tried to calm myself by reading a magazine. Quite some time later, after Mameha had fallen asleep in the seat beside me, I looked up to find Nobu standing in the aisle. "Sayori, are you well?" he said, speaking quietly so as not to wake Mameha. "I don't think Nobu-san has ever asked me such a thing before," I said. "He must be in a very cheerful mood."
"The future has never looked more promising."
Mameha stirred at the sound of our talking, so Nobu said nothing further and instead continued up the aisle to the toilet. Just before opening the door, he glanced back toward where the other men were seated. For an instant, I saw him from an angle I'd rarely seen, which gave him a look of fierce concentration. When his glance flicked in my direction, I thought he might pick up some hint that I felt as worried about my future as he felt reassured about his. How strange it seemed, when I thought about it, that Nobu understood me so little. Of course, a geisha who expects understanding from her donna is like a mouse expecting sympathy from the snake. And in any case, how could Nobu possibly understand anything about me when he'd seen me solely as a geisha, keeping my true self carefully concealed? The chairman was the only man I'd ever entertained as Sayori the geisha who had also known me as Chiyo. Though it was strange to think of it this way, for I'd never realized it before. What would Nobu have done if he had been the one to find me that day at the Shirakawa stream? Surely he would have walked right past. And how much easier it might have been for me if he had. I wouldn't spend my nights yearning for the chairman. I wouldn't stop in cosmetic shops from time to time to smell the scent of talc in the air and remind myself of his skin. I wouldn't strain to picture his presence beside me in some imaginary place. If you'd asked me why I wanted these things, I would have answered, "Why does a ripe persimmon taste delicious? Why does wood smell smoky when it burns?" But here I was again, like a girl trying to catch mice with her hands. Why couldn't I stop thinking about the chairman? I'm sure my anguish must have shown clearly on my face when the door to the toilet opened a moment later and the light snapped off. I couldn't bear for Nobu to see me this way, so I laid my head against the window pretending to be asleep. After he passed by, I opened my eyes again. I found that the position of my head had caused the curtains to pull open, so that I was looking outside the airplane for the first time since shortly after we'd lifted off the runway. Spread out below was a broad vista of aqua-blue ocean, mottled with the same jade green as a certain hair ornament Mameha sometimes wore. I never imagined the ocean with patches of green. From the sea cliffs in Yoroido, it had always looked the color of slate. Here the sea stretched all the way out to a single line pulled across like a wool thread where the sky began. This view wasn't frightening at all, but inexpressibly lovely. Even the hazy disk of the propeller was beautiful in its own way, and the silver wing had a kind of magnificence and was decorated with those symbols that American warplanes have on them. How peculiar it was to see them there, considering the world only 5 years earlier. We had fought a brutal war as enemies, and now what? We had given up our past. This was something I understood fully, for I had done it myself once. If only I could find a way of giving up my future. And then a frightening image came to mind. I saw myself cutting the bond of fate that held me to Nobu and watching him fall all the long way into the ocean below. I don't mean this was just an idea or some sort of daydream. I mean that all at once I understood exactly how to do it. Of course I wasn't really going to throw Nobu into the ocean, but I did have an understanding, just as clearly as if a window had been thrown open in my mind, of the one thing I could do to end my relationship with him forever. I didn't want to lose his friendship, but in my efforts to reach the chairman, Nobu was an obstacle I'd found no way around. And yet I could cause him to be consumed by the flames of his own anger. Nobu himself had told me how to do it. Just a moment after cutting his hand that night at the Ichiriki tea house only a few weeks earlier. If I was the sort of woman who would give myself to the minister, he'd said, he'd wanted me to leave the room right then and would never speak to me again. The feeling that came over me as I thought of this, it was like a fever breaking. I felt damp everywhere on my body. I was grateful Mameha remained asleep beside me. I'm sure she would have wondered what was the matter to see me short of breath, wiping my forehead with my fingertips. This idea that had come to me, could I really do such a thing? I don't mean the act of seducing the minister. I knew perfectly well I could do that. It would be like going to the doctor for a shot. I'd look the other way for a time, and it would be over. But could I do such a thing to Nobu? What a horrible way to repay his kindness. Compared with the sorts of men so many geisha had suffered through the years, Nobu was probably a very desirable donna. But could I bear to live a life in which my hopes had been extinguished forever? For weeks I'd been working to convince myself I could live it, but could I really? I thought perhaps I understood how Hatsumomo had come by her bitter cruelty, and Granny her meanness. Even Pumpkin, who was scarcely 30, had worn a look of disappointment for many years. The only thing that had kept me from it was hope. And now, to sustain my hopes, would I commit an abhorrent act? I'm not talking about seducing the minister. I'm talking about betraying Nobu's trust. During the rest of the flight, I struggled with these thoughts. I could never have imagined myself scheming in this way, but in time I began to imagine the steps involved just like in a board game. I would draw the minister aside at the inn. No, not at the inn, at some other place. And I would trick Nobu into stumbling upon us, or perhaps it would be enough for him to hear it from someone else. You can imagine how exhausted I felt by the end of the trip. Even as we left the airplane, I must have still looked very worried because Mameha kept reassuring me that the flight was over and I was safe at last. We arrived at our inn about an hour before sunset. The others admired the room in which we would all be staying, but I felt so agitated I could only pretend to admire it. It was as spacious as the largest room at the Ichiriki tea house, and furnished beautifully in the Japanese style with tatami mats and gleaming wood. One long wall was made entirely of glass doors, beyond which lay extraordinary tropical plants, some with leaves nearly as big as a man. A covered walkway led down through the leaves to the banks of a stream. When the luggage was in order, we were all of us quite ready for a bath. The inn had provided folding screens, which we opened in the middle of the room for privacy. We changed into our cotton gowns and made our way along a succession of covered walkways leading through the dense foliage to a luxurious hot springs pool at the other end of the inn. The men's and women's entrances were shielded by partitions and had separate tiled areas for washing. But once we were immersed in the dark water of the springs and moved out beyond the partition's edge, the men and women were together in the water. The bank director kept making jokes about Mameha and me, saying he wanted one of us to fetch a certain pebble or twig or something of the sort from the woods at the edge of the springs, the joke being, of course, that he wanted to see us naked. All this while, his son was engrossed in conversation with Pumpkin, and it didn't take us long to understand why. Pumpkin's bosoms, which were fairly large, kept floating up and exposing themselves on the surface while she jabbered away as always without noticing. Perhaps it seems odd to you that we all bathed together, men and women, and that we planned to sleep in the same room later that night. But actually, geisha do this sort of thing all the time with their best customers, or at least they did in my day. A single geisha who values her reputation will certainly never be caught alone with a man who isn't her donna. But to bathe innocently in a group like this with the murky water cloaking us, that's quite another matter, and as for sleeping in a group, we even have a word for it in Japanese. Zakone, fish sleeping. If you picture a bunch of mackerel thrown together into a basket, I suppose that's what it means. Bathing in a group like this was innocent, as I say, but that doesn't mean a hand never strayed where it shouldn't, and this thought was very much on my mind as I soaked there in the hot springs. If Nobu had been the sort of man to tease, he might have drifted over toward me, and then, after we'd chatted for a time, he might suddenly have grabbed me by the hip or, well, almost anywhere to tell the truth. The proper next step would be for me to scream and Nobu to laugh, and that would be the end of it. But Nobu wasn't the sort of man to tease. He'd been immersed in the bath for a time, in conversation with the chairman, but now he was sitting on a rock with only his legs in the water and a small wet towel draped across his hips. He wasn't paying attention to the rest of us, but rubbing at the stump of his arm absent-mindedly and peering into the water. The sun had set by now, and the light faded almost to evening, but Nobu sat in the brightness of a paper lantern. I'd never before seen him so exposed. The scarring that I thought was at its worst on one side of his face was every bit as bad on his damaged shoulder, though his other shoulder was beautifully smooth, like an egg. And now, to think that I was considering betraying him, he would think I had done it for only one reason, and would never understand the truth. I couldn't bear the thought of hurting Nobu or of destroying his regard for me. I wasn't at all sure I could go through with it. After breakfast the following morning, we all took a walk through the tropical forest to the sea cliffs nearby, where the stream from our inn poured over a picturesque little waterfall into the ocean. We stood a long while admiring the view. Even when we were all ready to leave, the chairman could hardly tear himself away. On the return trip, I walked beside Nobu, who was still as cheerful as I'd ever seen him. Afterward, we toured the island in the back of a military truck fitted with benches, and saw bananas and pineapples growing on the trees and beautiful birds. From the mountaintops, the ocean looked like a crumpled blanket in turquoise with stains of dark blue. That afternoon, we wandered the dirt streets of the little village and soon came upon an old wood building that looked like a warehouse with a sloped roof of thatch. We ended up walking around to the back, where Nobu climbed stone steps, to open a door at the corner of the building, and the sunlight fell across a dusty stage built out of planking. Evidently, it had at one time been a warehouse, but was now the town's theater. When I first stepped inside, I didn't think very much about it, but after the door banged shut and we made our way to the street again, I began to feel that same feeling of a fever breaking, because in my mind I had an image of myself lying there on the rutted flooring with the minister as the door creaked open and sunlight fell across us. We would have no place to hide. Nobu couldn't possibly fail to see us. In many ways, I'm sure it was the very spot I'd half hoped to find. But I wasn't thinking of these things. I wasn't really thinking at all, so much as struggling to put my thoughts into some kind of order. They felt to me like rice pouring from a torn sack. As we walked back up the hill toward our inn, I had to fall back from the group to take my handkerchief from my sleeve. It was certainly very warm there on that road, with the afternoon sun shining full onto our faces. I wasn't the only one perspiring, but Nobu came walking back to ask if I was all right. When I couldn't manage to answer him right away, I hoped he would think it was the strain of walking up the hill. "You haven't looked well all weekend, Sayori. Perhaps you ought to have stayed in Kyoto." "But when would I have seen this beautiful island?" "I'm sure this is the farthest you've ever been from your home. We're as far from Kyoto now as Hokkaido is." The others had walked around the bend ahead. Over Nobu's shoulder, I could see the eaves of the inn protruding above the foliage. I wanted to reply to him, but I found myself consumed with the same thoughts that had troubled me on the airplane, that Nobu didn't understand me at all. Kyoto wasn't my home, not in the sense Nobu seemed to mean it, of a place where I'd been raised, a place I'd never strayed from. And in that instant, while I peered at him in the hot sun, I made up my mind that I would do this thing I had feared. I would betray Nobu, even though he stood there looking at me with kindness. I tucked away my handkerchief with trembling hands, and we continued up the hill, not speaking a word. By the time I reached the room, the chairman and Mameha had already taken seats at the table to begin a game of Go against the bank director, with Shizue and her son looking on. The glass doors along the far wall stood open. The minister was propped on one elbow, staring out, peeling the covering off a short stalk of cane he'd brought back with him. I was desperately afraid Nobu would engage me in a conversation I'd be unable to escape, but in fact he went directly over to the table and began talking with Mameha. I had no idea as yet how I would lure the minister to the theater with me, and even less idea how I would arrange for Nobu to find us there. Perhaps Pumpkin would take Nobu for a walk if I asked her to. I didn't feel I could ask such a thing of Mameha, but Pumpkin and I had been girls together, and though I won't call her crude, as Auntie had called her, Pumpkin did have a certain coarseness in her personality and would be less aghast at what I was planning. I would need to direct her explicitly to bring Nobu to the old theater. They wouldn't come upon us there purely by accident. For a time, I knelt gazing out at the sunlit leaves and wishing I could appreciate the beautiful tropical afternoon. I kept asking myself whether I was fully sane to be considering this plan, but whatever misgivings I may have felt, they weren't enough to stop me from going ahead with it. Clearly, nothing would happen until I succeeded in drawing the minister aside, and I couldn't afford to call attention to myself when I did it. Earlier, he'd asked a maid to bring him a snack, and now he was sitting with his legs around a tray, pouring beer into his mouth, and dropping in globs of salted squid guts with his chopsticks. This may seem like a nauseating idea for a dish, but I can assure you that you'll find salted squid guts in bars and restaurants here and there in Japan. It was a favorite of my father's, but I've never been able to stomach it. I couldn't even watch the minister as he ate.
"Minister," I said to him quietly, "would you like me to find you something more appetizing?"
"No," he said, "I'm not hungry."
I must admit this raised in my mind the question of why he was eating in the first place. By now, Mameha and Nobu had wandered out the back door in conversation, and the others, including Pumpkin, were gathered around the Go board on the table. Apparently, the chairman had just made a blunder, and they were laughing. It seemed to me my chance had come.
"If you're eating out of boredom, Minister," I said, "why don't you and I explore the inn? I've been eager to see it, and we haven't had the time."
I didn't wait for him to reply, but stood and walked from the room. I was relieved when he stepped out into the hallway a moment later to join me. We walked in silence down the corridor until we came to a bend where I could see that no one was coming from either direction. I stopped.
"Excuse me," I said, "but shall we take a walk back down to the village together?"
He looked very confused by this.
"We have an hour or so left in the afternoon," I went on, "and I remember something I'd very much like to see again."
After a long pause, the minister said,
"I'll need to use the toilet first."
"Yes, that's fine," I told him. "You go and use the toilet, and when you're finished, wait right here for me, and we'll take a walk together. Don't go anywhere until I come and fetch you."
The minister seemed agreeable to this, and continued up the corridor. I went back toward the room, and I felt so dazed now that I was actually going through with my plan that when I put my hand on the door to slide it open, I could scarcely feel my fingers touching anything at all. Pumpkin was no longer at the table. She was looking through her travel trunk for something. At first, when I tried to speak, nothing came out. I had to clear my throat and try again.
"Excuse me, Pumpkin," I said. "Just one moment of your time."
She didn't look eager to stop what she was doing, but she left her trunk in disarray and came out into the hallway with me. I led her some distance down the corridor and then turned to her and said,
"Pumpkin, I need to ask a favor."
I waited for her to tell me she was happy to help, but she just stood with her eyes on me.
"I hope you won't mind my asking."
"Ask," she said.
"The minister and I are about to go for a walk. I'm going to take him to the old theater and..."
"Why?"
"So that he and I can be alone."
"The minister?" Pumpkin said incredulously.
"I'll explain some other time, but here's what I want you to do. I want you to bring Nobu there and Pumpkin, this will sound very strange. I want you to discover us.
What do you mean, discover you?
I want you to find some way of bringing Nobu there and opening the back door we saw earlier so that he'll see us.
While I was explaining this, Pumpkin had noticed the minister waiting in another covered walkway through the foliage. Now she looked back at me.
What are you up to, Sayori? She said.
I don't have time to explain it now, but it's terribly important, Pumpkin. Truthfully, my entire future is in your hands. Just make sure it's no one but you and Nobu, not the chairman, for heaven's sake, or anyone else. I'll repay you in any way you like.
She looked at me for a long moment. So it's time for a favor from Pumpkin again, is it? She said. I didn't feel certain what she meant by this, but rather than explaining it to me, she left. I wasn't sure whether or not Pumpkin had agreed to help, but all I could do at this point was go to the doctor for my shot, so to speak, and hope that she and Nobu would appear. I joined the minister in the corridor, and we set out down the hill. As we walked around the bend in the road and left the inn behind us, I couldn't help remembering the day Mameha had cut me on the leg and taken me to meet Dr. Crabb. On that afternoon, I'd felt myself in some sort of danger I couldn't fully understand, and I felt much the same way now. My face was as hot in the afternoon sun as if I'd sat too close to the hibachi, and when I looked at the minister, sweat was running down his temple onto his neck. If all went well, he would soon be pressing that neck against me. And at this thought, I took my folding fan from my obi and waved it until my arm was tired, trying to cool both myself and him. All the while, I kept up a flow of conversation until a few minutes later, when we came to a stop before the old theater with its thatched roof. The minister seemed puzzled. He cleared his throat and looked up at the sky.
"Will you come inside with me for a moment, Minister?" I said.
He didn't seem to know what to make of this, but when I walked down the path beside the building, he plodded along behind me. I climbed the stone steps and opened the door for him. He hesitated only a moment before walking inside. If he had frequented Gion all his life, he'd certainly have understood what I had in mind. Because a geisha who lures a man to an isolated spot has certainly put her reputation at stake, and a first-class geisha will never do such a thing casually. But the minister just stood inside the theater, in the patch of sunlight, like a man waiting for a bus. My hands were trembling so much as I folded my fan and tucked it into my obi again, I wasn't at all certain I could see my plan through to the end. The simple act of closing the door took all my strength, and then we were standing in the murky light, filtering under the eaves. Still, the minister stood inert, with his face pointed toward a stack of straw mats in the corner of the stage.
"Minister?" I said.
My voice echoed so much in the little hall, I spoke more quietly afterward.
"I understand you had a talk with the mistress of the Ichiriki about me. Isn't that so?"
He took in a deep breath, but ended up saying nothing.
"Minister, if I may," I said, "I'd like to tell you a story about a geisha named Kazuyo. She isn't in Gion any longer, but I knew her well at one time. A very important man, much like you, Minister, met Kazuyo one evening and enjoyed her company so much that he came back to Gion every night to see her. After a few months of this, he asked to be Kazuyo's dana, but the mistress of the tea-house apologized and said it wouldn't be possible. The man was very disappointed, but then, one afternoon, Kazuyo took him to a quiet spot where they could be alone, some place very much like this empty theater, and she explained to him that, even though he couldn't be her dana..."
The moment I said these last words, the minister's face changed like a valley when the clouds move away and sunlight rushes across it. He took a clumsy step toward me. At once my heart began to pound like drums in my ears. I couldn't help looking away from him and closing my eyes. When I opened them again, the minister had come so close we were nearly touching, and then I felt the damp fleshiness of his face against my cheek. Slowly he brought his body toward mine until we were pressed together. He took my arms, probably to pull me down onto the planking, but I stopped him.
"The stage is too dusty," I said. "You must bring over a mat from that stack."
"We'll go over there," the minister replied.
If we had lain down upon the mats in the corner, Nobu wouldn't have seen us in the sunlight when he opened the door.
"No, we mustn't," I said. "Please bring a mat here."
The minister did as I asked, and then stood with his hands by his side, watching me. Until this moment I'd half imagined something would stop us, but now I could see that nothing would. Time seemed to slow. My feet looked to me like someone else's when they stepped out of my lacquered zori and onto the mat. Almost at once the minister kicked off his shoes and was against me, with his arms around me tugging at the knot in my obi. I didn't know what he was thinking, because I certainly wasn't prepared to take off my kimono. I reached back to stop him. When I dressed that morning, I still hadn't quite made up my mind, but in order to be prepared, I'd very deliberately put on a gray underrobe I didn't much like, thinking it might be stained before the end of the day, and a lavender and blue kimono of silk gauze, as well as a durable silver obi. As for my undergarments, I'd shorten my kashimaki, my hip wrap, by rolling it at the waist, so that if I decided after all to seduce the minister, he'd have no trouble finding his way inside it. Now, when I withdrew his hands from around me, he gave me a puzzled look. I think he believed I was stopping him, and he looked very relieved as I lay down on the mat. It wasn't a tatami, but a simple sheet of woven straw. I could feel the hard flooring beneath. With one hand, I folded back my kimono and underrobe on one side so that my leg was exposed to the knee. The minister was still fully dressed, but he lay down upon me at once, pressing the knot of my obi into my back so much I had to raise one hip to make myself more comfortable. My head was turned to the side as well, because I was wearing my hair in a style known as Tsubushi Shimada, with a dramatic chion looped in the back, which would have been ruined if I'd put any weight on it. It was certainly an uncomfortable arrangement, but my discomfort was nothing compared with the uneasiness and anxiety I felt. Suddenly, I wondered if I'd been thinking at all clearly when I'd put myself in this predicament. The minister raised himself on one arm and began fumbling inside the seam of my kimono with his hand, scratching my thighs with his fingernails. Without thinking about what I was doing, I brought my hands up to his shoulders to push him away, but then I imagined Nobu as my Donna, and the life I would live without hope, and I took my hands away and settled them onto the mat again. The minister's fingers were squirming higher and higher along the inside of my thigh. It was impossible not to feel them. I tried to distract myself by focusing on the door. Perhaps it would open even now, before the minister had gone any further. But at that moment, I heard the jingling of his belt, and then the zip of his pants, and a moment later, he was forcing himself inside me. Somehow, I felt like a 15-year-old girl again, because the feeling was so strangely reminiscent of Dr. Crabb. I even heard myself whimper. The minister was holding himself up on his elbows, with his face above mine. I could see him out of only one corner of my eye. When viewed up close like this, with his jaw protruding toward me, he looked more like an animal than a human, and even this wasn't the worst part, for with his jaw jutted forward, the minister's lower lip became like a cup in which his saliva began to pool. I don't know if it was the squid guts he'd eaten, but his saliva had a kind of gray thickness to it, which made me think of the residue left on the cutting board after fish have been cleaned. When I dressed that morning, I'd tucked several sheets of a very absorbent rice paper into the back of my obi. I hadn't expected to need them until afterward, when the minister would want them for wiping himself off, if I decided to go through with it, that is. Now it seemed I would need a sheet much sooner, to wipe my face when his saliva spilled onto me. With so much of his weight on my hips, however, I couldn't get my hand into the back of my obi. I let out several little gasps as I tried, and I'm afraid the minister mistook them for excitement, or in any case, he suddenly grew even more energetic, and now the pool of saliva in his lip was being jostled with such violent shock waves, I could hardly believe it held together rather than spilling out in a stream. All I could do was pinch my eyes shut and wait. I felt as sick as if I had been lying in the bottom of a little boat, tossed about on the waves, and with my head banging again and again against the side. Then, all at once, the minister made a groaning noise and held very still for a bit, and at the same time I felt his saliva spill onto my cheek. I tried again to reach the rice paper in my obi, but now the minister was lying collapsed upon me, breathing as heavily as if he'd just run a race. I was about to push him off when I heard a scraping sound outside. My feelings of disgust had been so loud within me, they'd nearly drowned out everything else. But now that I remembered Nobu, I could feel my heart pounding once again. I heard another scrape. It was the sound of someone on the stone steps. The minister seemed to have no idea what was about to happen to him. He raised his head and pointed it toward the door with only the mildest interest, as if he expected to see a bird there. And then the door creaked open, and the sunlight flooded over us. I had to squint, but I could make out two figures. There was Pumpkin. She had come to the theater just as I'd hoped she would. But the man peering down from beside her wasn't Nobu at all. I had no notion of why she had done it, but Pumpkin had brought the chairman instead. Chapter 34. I can scarcely remember anything after that door opened, for I think the blood may have drained out of me. I went so cold and numb. I know the minister climbed off me, or perhaps I pushed him off. I do remember weeping and asking if he'd seen the same thing I had, whether it really had been the chairman standing there in the doorway. I hadn't been able to make out anything of the chairman's expression, with the late afternoon sun behind him, and yet when the door closed again, I couldn't help imagining I'd seen on his face some of the shock I myself was feeling. I didn't know if the shock was really there, and I doubted it was. But when we feel pain, even the blossoming trees seem weighted and suffering to us. And in just the same way, after seeing the chairman there, well, I would have found my own pain reflected on anything I'd looked at. If you consider that I'd taken the minister to that empty theater for the very purpose of putting myself in danger so that the knife would come slamming down onto the chopping block, so to speak, I'm sure you'll understand that amid the worry and fear and disgust that almost overwhelmed me, I'd also been feeling a certain excitement. In the instant before that door opened, I could almost sense my life expanding just like a river whose waters have begun to swell. For I had never before taken such a drastic step to change the course of my own future. I was like a child tiptoeing along a precipice overlooking the sea. And yet somehow I hadn't imagined a great wave might come and strike me there and wash everything away. When the chaos of feelings receded and I slowly became aware of myself again, Mameha was kneeling above me. I was puzzled to find that I wasn't in the old theater at all any longer, but rather looking up from the tatami floor of a dark little room at the inn. I don't recall anything about leaving the theater, but I must have done it somehow. Later, Mameha told me I'd gone to the proprietor to ask for a quiet place to rest. He'd recognized that I wasn't feeling well and had gone to find Mameha soon afterward. Fortunately, Mameha seemed willing to believe I was truly ill and left me there. Later, as I wandered back toward the room in a daze with a terrible feeling of dread, I saw Pumpkin step out into the covered walkway ahead of me. She stopped when she caught sight of me. But rather than hurrying over to apologize, as I half expected she might, she turned her focus slowly toward me like a snake that had spotted a mouse.
"Pumpkin," I said, "I asked you to bring Nobu, not the chairman. I don't understand."
"Yes, it must be hard for you to understand, Sayuri, when life doesn't work out perfectly."
"Perfectly? Nothing worse could have happened. Did you misunderstand what I was asking you?"
"You really do think I'm stupid," she said. I was bewildered and stood a long moment in silence.
"I thought you were my friend," I said at last.
"I thought you were my friend too once, but that was a long time ago."
"You talk as if I've done something to harm you, Pumpkin, but..."
"No, you'd never do anything like that, would you? Not the perfect Miss Nitta Sayuri. I suppose it doesn't matter that you took my place as the daughter of the Okya. Do you remember that, Sayuri? After I'd gone out of my way to help you with that doctor, whatever his name was, after I'd risk making Hatsumomo furious at me for helping you, then you turned it all around and stole what was mine. I've been wondering all these months just why you brought me into this little gathering with the minister. I'm sorry it wasn't so easy for you to take advantage of me this time."
"But Pumpkin," I interrupted, "couldn't you just have refused to help me? Why did you have to bring the chairman?"
She stood up to her full height. I know perfectly well how you feel about him, she said. Whenever there's nobody looking, your eyes hang all over him like fur on a dog. She was so angry she had bitten her lip. I could see a smudge of lipstick on her teeth. She'd set out to hurt me, I know.